So are you all comfortable sitting nice and relaxed? And if that's the case, we can start the Dhamma talk for this evening. And tonight I'm going to talk about contemplation on the Buddhist path, how to contemplate, how to reflect on the Dhamma, and how to make this one of the aspects of your practice. And one of the reasons I want to talk about this is because people often ask me this question, how do you contemplate? How do you reflect on the Dhamma in a way that obviously is useful? And people often seem a bit stumped on how to do this. And I think part of the reason is because a lot of different instructions are given. Sometimes people will be taught Vipassana meditation. And so one of the questions is the idea of contemplation in the Dhamma, is that the same as Vipassana? This is what Vipassana means, like clear seeing. It's often translated as insight or insight meditation, but I think clear seeing is a more appropriate translation of that word. So is contemplation the same as Vipassana, or is it something different? This is one of the things I want to talk about, and also in general, how can we actually do contemplation of the Dhamma? So hopefully some of you who are confused about this, hopefully this will give some of the answers. If not, you can complain afterwards, but not straight away. Just hold your complaints a while there. So this is one of the right contemplations, to hold your complaints for a while. Anyway, so idea of contemplation, one of the suttas is the word of the Buddha, And it's a beautiful word of the Buddha. I really recommend you read some of the word of the Buddha if you haven't done so already. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands because it's interesting, but not tonight. Tonight may be the wrong time to do that. But one of the suttas, one of these discourses or talks of the Buddha that really struck me when I first read it. And I talk about this sutta all the time. And this particular sutta is found in the numerical discourses of the Buddha. And the Buddha says there that there is two powers. This is already interesting. The idea of a power, what does a power mean in Buddhism? And the idea of a power is like a mental faculty or a mental quality that overpowers something else, that has power over some other quality. So in Buddhism, the idea of a power is something that has the ability to stop unwholesome qualities of mind and gives rise to the good ones. So it's pretty useful, if it can overpower the unwholesome qualities of mind, the anger, the maybe drowsiness, the greed or whatever it is, if it can overpower that, it's very, very useful. So this is very interesting. What are these two powers? Because these are obviously about the fundamental things that make us make progress on the Buddhist path. And these two powers, says the Buddha here, this is the power of reflection. If you like contemplation, reflection is pretty much the same thing. Power of reflection is one of those powers. And the other one is the power of development, called the bhavana bala. Bhavana is like the Pali word for meditation, for development of the mind. These are the two powers. So what this is saying is that reflection is a power. Reflection is a way of overcoming the unwholesome qualities that we have in our life. This is basically what it's saying. And the other way of doing it is through bhavana, through development of the meditation practice that we do. These are the two things. So what is the difference between these two powers? And this is where it gets really interesting here. Because the power of development, as you might expect, the power of developing the mind is all about meditation practice. It's about watching the breath. It's about getting into deep states of samadhi. Samadhi is the stillness and peace and the bliss of the mind, the jhanas and these kind of things. That is what that part is about. But the power of reflection actually comes prior to the power of meditation. It is more fundamental, more basic aspect of this path. Why? Because the power of reflection, if you want to overcome the unwholesome qualities of body, speech, and mind, if you want to develop the wholesome qualities of body, speech, and mind, that is done by the power of reflection. Isn't that kind of interesting? I found that so interesting when I saw that. And the reason why I found it so interesting here was because I had always thought that meditation is really the end-all and be-all of Buddhism. If you meditate, you develop the good qualities, you get rid of the bad qualities, and all of this, and meditation can do all of this stuff. But the Buddha says, no, actually, it just doesn't work like that. Meditation is to develop the mind once the majority of defilements and problems have already been abandoned. That is when meditation starts. Prior to that, it is reflection and contemplation that is the most powerful thing. That's why it's called the power. So what that means is that if we want to have success in our meditation practice, first of all, before that, we have to develop the power of reflection. Think in the right way, so we can overcome unwholesome qualities, develop the good qualities, become more moral people, more good-hearted people, having more good qualities inside of us. We can become more a blessing for the world around us and also for ourselves. And this happens, very interestingly, through the power of reflection. And the power of development, the power of meditation, comes later on, when the mind is already very pure, to a very pure state. So what are we doing here tonight? Well, what we're doing here tonight is doing a little bit of meditation, which hopefully can help us to use that power of reflection afterwards. So to me, anyway, it was an eye-opener to me, because I started to understand the path in an entirely new light. And if you read the word of the Buddha more generally and very broadly, you will realize that all meditation on the Buddhist path is based on virtue, based on kindness, based on morality. Without that, there is no development of meditation at all. And that is when you can start to understand why there are these two powers and why they are different. That is kind of the starting point. So the question then is, how do we develop this reflection? How do we do these reflections so as to develop the good qualities and reduce the bad ones? Now, reflection or contemplation can happen at many stages on the Buddhist path. It is, as I've been suggesting now, at the very foundation of the path, even before you come to meditation practice. But of course, contemplation also comes with the meditation practice, because you need to contemplate to move the meditation forward. And it also comes at the very end of the path, because at the very end of the path, the contemplation is what really drives you towards those powerful insights that are really the crux, the critical thing that Buddhism is all about. But the most important of all these meditations, of these contemplations or reflections for the vast majority of people, is the first one. The simple one, the fundamental one, the one that actually forms a basis for the meditation practice. If you get this right, then your meditation will flow beautifully, especially when you have a bit of time to go on retreat or to stay for yourself or go somewhere and just withdraw a little bit. Your meditation will happen almost automatically, because you come to the meditation with a fairly pure heart already. So this is the most important one. The other ones will tend to come as a consequence of this most basic contemplation. So how do we do this? So the purpose here is to overcome the unwholesome qualities and build up the good qualities. Yeah? How do we do that? And this is something you do throughout your daily life. Throughout all the activities that you do during the day, whether you are at work, whether you are with your family, whether you are, whatever it is that you're doing, maybe not when you, I was going to say when you're watching television, but I'm not sure if it works. It's hard to contemplate when you're watching television. Maybe not. Maybe sometimes you can if you're really smart. But usually contemplation happens when you're not watching television. That's probably one of those times. I'm sorry about that, but that's kind of how it works. So how do we do it? The answer is that, very often in daily life, situations come up that prompt us, that remind us of the Buddhist path. There are many such situations. One of those situations, for example, you are working with somebody and maybe a little thought of irritation might arise. Obviously, this can happen quite regularly for many people, that little thoughts of irritation arise when you're working with someone. It even happens at the monastery, believe it or not. Maybe you believe it. Okay, it's not that amazing. It happens everywhere. It's part of the human nature that these things happen. So you these little irritations happen, and sometimes at that moment there is a chance to use reflection wisely to turn the mind in another direction. So what do you do? Well, what you do is, you know, and I just remember the other day I was working with a team of people at the monastery, and monastery people are really nice, and it suddenly occurred to me what a wonderful thing it is to be able to work with people who are working in such a nice way, everybody working in a team. Yeah, that's not always the case, of course, but sometimes everyone works together in a beautiful way, carrying the job forward, everyone kind of putting their effort into it. And I thought, wow, how fortunate I am to have these co-workers working with me. Yeah, what a lucky thing it is to be able to work with people like this. And straight away, I felt that sense of gratitude, a sense of something very positive with the people I was working with. And it struck me at the time how easy it was. All you have to do is shift your attention a little bit, reflect a little bit differently. And as you do that, this wonderful quality, wonderful feeling arises on that basis. And this is something everyone can do. It is not that hard. Sometimes you can see maybe a problem arising and you shift your attention and you think, wow, actually, I'm so fortunate to have these people in my life, in my family, in my job, at the Buddha Society, wherever it is. What a wonderful thing that is. And to see the good qualities and how they act and how they try their very best. Sometimes their best may not be so great because we all have different abilities. Someone may not be able to work that hard because of whatever reason. But instead of judging them, we allow them to be who they are and to see the positive qualities in that person. This is a simple way of reflecting, moving you away from getting irritated perhaps or being neutral about somebody, to remind yourself of the positive qualities that are almost always there when you want to look. This is kind of how reflection is used. One of the things about contemplation or reflection is that it is often very simple. We tend to think that contemplation and reflection is something that is very profound. Yeah, you've got to think about dependent origination. You've got to reflect on the five aggregates, the five khandhas, it's called in the Pali language. If you don't know what these things mean, never mind, it doesn't matter. I'm just saying it because it kind of makes a point for those of you who know more about the Dhamma. You may think that you have to reflect and contemplate on the six sense bases. You may think that you have to understand the Four Noble Truths or whatever, all of these things. But actually, it is often much simpler than that. The simple, basic reflection that you do in your daily life to guide your mind in the right way, as I've just suggested, these are the most powerful things you can do, because they will drive your mind forward and you will actually find, over time, your mind really does become more pure. Your mind really does have less defilements. You feel better about yourself. Yeah. And you think, wow, this path is really working. That is really where the hard work is. Another example of a simple contemplation is attitude to our parents. Yeah, it is very easy in life to go through life, or it can be other family members as well, and to kind of have a normal familiar relationships with your family, because family is so close. After a while, we get so used to each other. Everything is just habit, and there's no sense of appreciation or anything like that after a while. But one of the things you can do, if you reflect wisely, is to reflect and gain some gratitude for what your parents have done for you. Remembering that your parents brought you up, remembering that your parents taught you all the basic things in life. Remember that your parents had endless patience with you sometimes when you were really naughty. Is anyone here who were naughty when they were young? Is anyone who was not naughty when they were young? Everybody's been naughty when they were young. Even when Bharada probably was a bit naughty when he was young. I certainly was, This is just the way things are. So you remember that patience, that metta, that loving kindness that comes from parents. You remember what they taught you. You remember all of these things. And as you start to shift your attitude a little bit, and this is done through reflection, you start to gain a degree of gratitude and patience with your parents. It changes your entire outlook. You look at things in a different way. This is, again, reflection. Very powerful. And one of the reasons this particular reflection is very powerful, for some people it's going to be difficult because it depends on the kind of relationship we had with our parents. But it is very powerful because our relationship with our parents is such a powerful factor on the spiritual path. It is one of the foundational things that actually makes the spiritual path work. Simple, yeah, but very profound. Another example, which is very important, I think, on the spiritual path, is how to overcome ill will. Yeah, anger, negativity in our life is another one of these very important things. And so you will notice that sometimes you're doing something, ill will towards somebody arises. It is quite natural. Yeah, don't judge yourself if that happens, because it is very unlikely that anyone here never has any kind of ill will. Ill will is very much part and parcel of what it means to be reborn in the human realm. So don't judge yourself. Instead of judging, stand back and watch what is happening. This is like reflection and contemplation. Yeah. You stand back, and what you see, of course, is that you see that there are certain causes for the arising of that ill will. You see that the cause very often is looking at the negative quality of that person. And that is when you start to understand what you have to do. All you have to do to change that ill will is to look at the positive quality of that person instead. And as you do that, the ill will dies down. Yeah, this is done through reflection, by thinking about things in the right way, or by having compassion for them. Because if someone is really bad, actually they are suffering enormously. I could go on about tackling ill will for a long time, because it's actually a very interesting topic. But that is the basic outlook on how to tackle ill will. So remember that. This is how you reflect. If you get upset with somebody, okay, don't try to use the reflection straight away, because you need a bit of distance, you need a bit of mindfulness to be able to do that. So allow yourself to cool down a little bit, and then remind yourself of these things. Yeah, how to actually overcome this. Again, using reflection to overcome these problems. Same thing with metta. Yeah, having a sense of metta towards the people, kindness, friendliness towards the people around you. That metta also arises from seeing the good qualities in people around you. What is friendliness? What is it to see, to be friendly towards somebody? It is usually to see the good qualities in them. Another simple way of reflecting in daily life is to use what is very common in the suttas of the Buddha, which is the death contemplation. A simple reminder that you're going to die. Yeah, we're all going to die one day. And one of the things, this was a man who told me about this when I was in Brisbane many, many years ago. And he said that to me, that every day when he left his house, he would remind himself, today I could die. Yeah, and then he said, well, once I had that thought in my mind, today I could die, then I wouldn't leave my house without making sure he had left his wife and his kids in a good way, not after some argument or some negative thing, but this would always allow him to leave his family in a good way, because he remembered, I could die today. If I'm going to die, I don't want to die just having had an argument with somebody. What a terrible thing to do. So he actually left his house in a good way every time. It's a simple way of using the death reflection to remind you of what really matters in life. And we can take that further. It's not just about what you do in the morning when you leave your house. Yeah, you can take this every time you meet somebody in your everyday life. You can remember, this might be the last time you see them. Yeah, tonight might be the last time I see you guys. Is that likely? It's possible. I'm not sure if it's likely, but it's possible. And because it's possible, I would like to leave in a good state. I don't want to leave here after having argued with you. Yeah, so I'm probably not going to argue with you during this talk. Unlikely. So, because if you know that you're going to die, yeah, you want to say goodbye in a good way to people around you. You cannot really afford to be enemies with other people. Cannot really afford to have an argument with anyone. Why? Because you could die afterwards. And then you will die in a way that it feels negative, that feels unpleasant, because precisely because of that argument. If you imagine yourself on your deathbed, you're about to die, the last thing you want to do on your deathbed is to have an argument with somebody. Can you imagine lying on your deathbed and kind of having an argument? It would be nuts, wouldn't it? It would be completely weird. You're about to leave this world. Leave me in peace. Yeah, oh, it's so peaceful here. Yeah, okay. May you be well and happy. And now I just want to die in peace. That's how people want to die. So this is how you use a simple reflection like death. This is how death makes you a good person. Yeah, it makes you a good person because you understand the fragility of life, how quickly things can go wrong, and then you leave all people in a good state because of that. So these are some of the examples of reflection. There's many more examples. One of the examples that I like to think of as well is to reflect on the Buddha as your teacher. This can be a very powerful reflection. Maybe the more of a Buddhist you are, the more powerful it becomes. But remember, the Buddha is a pretty awesome character, yeah? Using modern lingo, awesome character. The Buddha, as far as I'm concerned, when you read his discourses, he is the greatest spiritual genius of human history. There's something very powerful about the way he speaks, and he is your teacher. Isn't that kind of astonishing? Here is this man, lived 2,500 years ago, who had the profoundest insight into reality that you can have in terms of understanding the human condition, who fully understand happiness and suffering. Yeah, and this is exactly what we want, isn't it? He knows exactly what you want, and he knows it from all the various angles, and he can teach you about it, how to get there, all of these kind of things. This person is your teacher. Ultimately, yeah, I'm just trying to parrot the Buddha. I'm not sure if I'm succeeding very well, but I'm trying anyway. I'm doing my best. Yeah. So this is your ultimate teacher. Imagine having someone like that as your teacher. Anyone, any other teacher kind of pales by comparison compared to the Buddha, with all his insight and understanding of reality and all the teachings that he has left for us and that still are available. Sometimes it gives you goosebumps when you think of that kind of person being behind the scene. And one of the things I like to remind people of is that when the Buddha gave his teachings, it wasn't just to the people that were around at the time. Sometimes we tend to think the Buddha lived 2,500 years ago, different culture, different time, it doesn't relate to us. But it does. It does because the Buddha knew that when he started the wheel of the Dhamma, this teaching would be going on for centuries and millennia after his passing away. So he expressed his teachings in such a way that they really are about universal principles of the human condition rather than being specific to any particular culture or time. Yeah? So when you read them, it's like they come alive. When you read them, you realize the Buddha was thinking about the future people, just like all of us sitting here today. And again, it gives you goosebumps when you think about that. It's really powerful. And if that doesn't work for you, then do another reflection. Think about someone like Ajahn Brahm. Yeah, Ajahn Brahm, I'm not saying he is the Buddha, but he is pretty amazing. I don't know if you think he doesn't just tell jokes, right? I hope you're aware of that. People think Ajahn Brahm is number one, he's just a joker, but he's not just a joker. This is kind of the thing that people often misunderstand about Ajahn Brahm. I came to Bodhinyana Monastery over 25 years ago, and the reason I came to Bodhinyana Monastery is that I heard one talk by Ajahn Brahm. I had already been to a few other monasteries, but I knew this is my teacher. I knew it straight away. This is my teacher. Why? Because his teachings really are authentic. I felt there's something very powerful about these teachings. Very, very strong. And then I came all the way from, I was living in the UK at the time, I think. Yeah, I live in something like that, UK, I think. And then I came all the way, I called Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn, can I come? And he said, yeah, who are you? And I said, yeah, why, please, may I come? He said, okay, you can come to Australia. So I came down to Australia after calling up Ajahn Brahm. I was a bit cheeky. I just kind of called him up on the spot and said, can I come down? And usually that works out, yeah, if you are genuinely in. So be a bit cheeky in life. I really recommend that. Don't be too kind of demure and subdued. Sometimes it's good to be a bit upfront and just kind of say things the way they are. Yeah? Don't tell Ajahn Brahm I said this, because otherwise I get into trouble. But that's, you know, it's a good piece of advice. So I came to Australia, and after I came to Australia, I kind of looked at Ajahn Brahm. I wanted to check him out. You're supposed to check out a teacher. But one of the astonishing things about Ajahn Brahm, which has happened to me, is that I've been with him for 25 years, and my respect for Ajahn Brahm has increased each of those 25 years, always growing stronger. Part of that is because I have probably developed a little bit myself. And as you develop yourself, you see the qualities in someone like Ajahn Brahm. You see the steadiness. You see the consistency, yeah? The consistent kindness, the consistent with kind of detachment from the world, yeah? The consistent ability to deal with any difficulty, regardless of what it is. You see the Dhamma lived out in reality. And this is kind of what is so powerful with Ajahn Brahm. So when you listen to Ajahn Brahm, listen carefully. Okay, some of his jokes are just jokes, but a lot of his stories actually have a very profound meaning, even though they may seem funny or whatever. Listen to them very carefully. Listen where he's coming from. Listen to the way he talks, because the way he is very often a large part of the message. Yeah, he is someone who is very light, someone who doesn't take life too seriously, someone who is almost always peaceful, someone who has the ability to, you know, to when if the monastery burns down and Olamara were to be blown up by a terrorist, he would say, oh yeah, whatever, and he would just walk off. This is Ajahn Brahm in a nutshell. Very little attachment there to anyone or to anything. He's an extraordinarily impressive monk, if you know what I'm talking about. This is what I was attracted to, yeah? I came, wow, I've got to have this monk I want to have as my teacher. And that is what I have got. And I feel sorry for Ajahn Brahm having a disciple like me as his disciple, because, you know, I'm not so argumentative anymore, but I used to be really, really argumentative. Yeah, everything. What, Ajahn, you can't say this, it says this in the sutta. And he would always be patient, always take the time to explain things. And what a marvelous example of what he was. So remember that. You have a jewel as part of this Buddha society, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah? What a wonderful thing that is. Feel blessed. Count your blessings. These are some of the really great blessings in your life, that you have these things. It is very hard to come by in the world, these kind of teachers. So feel blessed by that. And if you do, you feel joyful. Wow. Actually, what a wonderful thing it is that we have this Buddha society with all the good people around, with people like Ajahn Brahm to teach us. This is called like Sanghanusati, recollection of the Sangha, and it's a way of reflecting and contemplating about these things. And then you broaden that out and appreciate the whole Buddhist community here, reflect on what a wonderful thing it is to have friends like this in the spiritual life, the Kalyanamitta. Broaden that out as far as you like, yeah? And when you think in this way, what you're doing is you're overcoming the defilements of the mind, they are going down. You're building up some very beautiful and powerful states inside of you as a consequence. Yeah, this is how it works. This is what reflection is about. When you reflect rightly in this way, you are overcoming the negative things, building up the positive things. This is the way it is supposed to happen. So these are some examples, yeah? How to reflect, you can see how simple it is, yeah? There's nothing profound. It is very profound, because if you do it properly, it gives rise to very positive qualities. But there's nothing difficult about it. It's something everyone can do. You just have to apply yourself to these things, and they happen. Another kind of reflection that you can do is reflecting on what is called right view in Buddhism. Yeah, one of the aspects of right view in Buddhism is the idea of rebirth. So if you, I don't know what you feel about rebirth, if you think rebirth is nonsense, that's okay, that's no problem, so this reflection won't be for you. But if you think rebirth is a possibility, then reflect on what that actually means. What does it entail? Yeah, so think about yourself, okay, you are dying, and then after you're dying, you can read about the near-death experiences. Yeah, people kind of float out of their body. They think, oh, that's my body, gee, okay, what happened? Oh, I'm here now, okay, what happens next? And you kind of, maybe you're a bit confused or something, yeah, you're not sure what's going on. So what does that mean? Well, what it means is that if there is such a thing as rebirth, yeah, and this is what I mean by reflecting on these things, understand the consequences, understand how this impacts on how you live your life. Well, it means that once you're out of your body, you still want to be happy. Yeah, you still want to feel good about yourself. Yeah, it's not as if when you come to your death, that's it, and then afterwards you don't care about how you feel. Of course, you want to feel happy afterwards as well. Oop, I'm here now, okay, I still want to be happy. So what that means is that during our current life, we also look out for ourself after we have died. We broaden out our horizon. We think about things differently. We don't limit our scope to this life. We think about the long term. How can I secure my happiness in the long term? And then you might get reborn after that. Yeah, you go to this intermediate stage maybe, and then you get reborn into another life. Well, you want to ensure in this life that also your future life is going to be okay. You don't want to destroy or kind of make everything really miserable for yourself in your future life. What a stupid thing that would be. So what does rebirth entail? What are the consequences of the idea of rebirth? And it changes your attitude to how you look at the world. It's another way of reflecting. There's many more ways, but these are some of the basic ways. One of the most important ones is learning how to reflect. If you feel that there is some anger or ill will arising in you, one of the very most important things, and if you can reflect even that much and change your mind in a different direction, it's going to be very, very powerful for you on your spiritual path. And this kind of reflection doesn't really matter so much what kind of person you are, what you believe in, because everybody can gain the benefit and understand the benefit of that. So this is the beginning. And these contemplations are by far the most important ones on the spiritual path. They are not the kind of things that you learn on a Vipassana retreat, but these are the things that will really support you and empower your meditation practice, and very often not talked enough about. So this is how you contemplate. Make it personal. Yeah, one of the problems of contemplation is that people sometimes they want to have an exact explanation of how to contemplate. They want to have a formula. Yeah, they want to have a recipe. Contemplate like this. But don't follow a recipe. Don't follow a formula too much. If you follow a formula, you become like a robot. And robots don't get that much insight. Isn't that right? Can a robot become enlightened? No. So you have to kind of get out of the robot paradigm and become into the human paradigm instead. So the way to reflect is something that is more close to your heart, something that kind of works for you. Yeah. So don't follow a pattern too much. Get the general idea, then ask yourself, well, I'm getting upset now. What is the right way to think about this? Okay, this person has these good qualities, so I'll focus on those. What a wonderful thing that they have these good qualities. Wow, why am I getting upset at all? It's silly. Okay. Upset, abandoned. Or this person, wow, they have a really terrible time. How, you know, all these bad qualities, how did they get them? I don't know, but they must have had some terrible thing happening in the past. You have compassion for them. This is how you make it your contemplation. Yeah? Make it yours. Make it meaningful to you. Don't follow set formulas and things too much. Sometimes we like set formulas because then we know what we can do. The problem with set formulas, they don't work all that well because they're not personal enough. They don't actually relate to you personally and your character. So this is the beginning. If you can do a little bit of what I've been talking about now, you're going to go a long, long way already on the Buddhist path. But there is more. Yeah? The second thing of contemplation is the kind of contemplation that we do in our meditation practice. And you will have noticed just at the end of the meditation now, I said, reflect back on the meditation. Yeah? Think about what had happened. So I said specifically, if you feel more peaceful or at ease or more comfortable than you did when you started out, why is that the case? Yeah? And what you will notice, if you're very careful, I can tell you now already what you will notice. What you will notice is that the reason why you're feeling more peaceful is because there is a reduction in defilements, a reduction in hindrances, a reduction in problems in your mind. Yeah? There is less desire there. There is less attachment. There is less thinking about the world outside, which is all about desire and things. There is less ill will. All of these negative qualities have gone down. And then you ask yourself, well, what is the cause for this? What is the cause for the peace in the meditation? And then you start to understand the causes that reduce those defilements of the mind. And it's actually very simple. Yeah, the reason why you feel desire for anything is because you contemplate the benefit of that object. You contemplate why it's beautiful. It's called the subha nimitta in Pali. It means that you're contemplating the aspect of beauty in that object. Then you feel desire for it. When you feel desire, your mind becomes restless. The mind goes outside. You lose your meditation. So you need to withdraw your mind from that, take less interest in the world, and you become peaceful. It's quite simple, yeah, but make it your own insight. Look at these things, find out whether this is true, make it specific to specific examples in your own life, then they become powerful for you. The same thing with ill will. You see a little bit of irritation arising in your mind. You see it arises because you are looking at the negative quality of the object. So you change your attention. You look at things in a different way. So this is how you reflect at the end of your meditation. You see the causes for meditation to work. Yeah, you see how the hindrances, the problems of the mind change, how they come about, and thereby also how you eliminate them for the future. This is how it works. It may not be easy. Yeah, I'm not saying that this is very easy necessarily to do, and you may wonder tonight, how can I get all of that out of this meditation tonight? And you can't. This is something you do over time. It takes time to uncover these things. It is not simple. Yeah, it takes again and again, you look at it, and as you do that, you start to uncover these things. So that is how you use this insight in your meditation practice, or this contemplation as part of your meditation practice. Look back at what is happening here. Look at the progress. Look at the process of meditation. Understand how the bits come together. Why are you peaceful? Why are you not peaceful? Yeah? And in this way, you can eliminate those hindrances that stop you from gaining peace in meditation practice. So at this point, I want to talk a little bit about samatha and vipassana, because samatha and vipassana relate very closely to what I have been talking about. And for those of you who don't know, the word samatha and vipassana are Pali words. Samatha means calm, yeah, and vipassana is often translated as insight, but I prefer clear seeing as a translation for vipassana. Now, these two are, you would often hear maybe in Buddhist meditation circles that there is samatha, calm meditation, or vipassana, insight meditation. Yeah, this is kind of thing we hear about in Buddhist circles. So how does this thing with vipassana and samatha, how does this relate to contemplation and meditation that I've been talking about before? Is it the case that vipassana, clear seeing, insight, is the same as contemplation? Is that the case? Many people think that, yeah? If you contemplate, you're doing vipassana because you are seeing things more clearly. But is that really the case? And this is actually very interesting, because very often what we hear in meditation circles in the world and what the Buddha taught is often not the same. We need to go back to the word of the Buddha to really get the full benefits of his teachings. Remember, the Buddha is the originator of Buddhism. Yeah, he is the one. Everything else is based on his teachings. And that is why everything else only has meaning in light of his teachings. And that is why going back to his teachings is so useful, yeah, because everything else comes from that and it has no meaning without that. So we need to ask, what did the Buddha say about samatha and vipassana, about calm and clear seeing or insight? And what the Buddha says about this, which is so fascinating, he says that they always go together. If you read the word of the Buddha in Pali, have you ever read the word of the Buddha in Pali? Okay, not many people have, yeah? I'm just saying that just to be a bit silly. But if you do, because one of the great things about being a monk or a nun, because you do this full time, you have time to learn Pali, yeah? So I learned Pali from Ajahn Brahma, and I've done a lot of translation from Pali into English myself, yeah? One of the great, wonderful things to be able to do as a Buddhist monk. Yeah? And when you read the suttas, the word of the Buddha in Pali, what you see is that samatha and vipassana, calm and clear seeing, always go together. They go together in a compound called samatha vipassana. They're always compounded, yeah? Which means that essentially they go together. They can't really separate them. That's what it means. And you may have heard, sometimes Ajahn Brahm tells the stories from the time when he was a young monk in Thailand. He was always a young monk in Thailand. And he says, you know, some of the stories are about his teacher, Ajahn Chah. Yeah, Ajahn Chah was this, if you don't know, he was an incredibly famous monk in Thailand. I just did a funeral service yesterday, and I was saying to Ajahn Chah's funeral, I said, it was about 1 million people came to his funeral. And I said, I'm glad there aren't that many people here today. And sometimes you get a smile, even at funerals, when you say these things, which is kind of nice. People can smile at a funeral. But it's 1 million people came to his funeral. You can imagine what it was like. Complete chaos, basically. That's what it was like. That's how famous he was. And he is also the monk in Thailand with the most disciples from outside of Thailand. Disciples from everywhere around the world. So very, very famous. And he said, he was considered one of the greatest meditation masters in the 20th century. He said that samatha vipassana, clear seeing and calm, they are like two sides of a knife. Two sides of a knife are obviously inseparable. Maybe if you are a Zen Buddhist, they are not inseparable, but if you're not a Zen Buddhist, they are inseparable. Samatha on one side, vipassana on the other, calm on one side, and insight on the other. They have to come together. A knife cannot only have one side. I don't think so. Again, unless it's a koan, but this is not a koan, this is a reality, this is a real knife, not a koan knife. So this is what he said. And when you start reading the suttas, that's exactly what it says in the suttas. Why is that the case? Why is it that samatha and vipassana has to come together? This is such an important understanding. I was struggling with this myself. I didn't really understand the connection here. The only thing you have to, all I had to go by really was the suttas and some of these wise teachers. But you start to realize after a while that the reason why they have to go together is because they are caused by the same thing. If something has exactly the same cause, well, then they have to arise together. This is such a, when I got that, I realized that these things are basically two sides of exactly the same coin. It cannot be separated. So what is it that causes samatha and vipassana? Well, what causes it is the abandoning of the defilements, the problems in the mind. As you abandon these things, both samatha, both calm and clear seeing arise as a consequence. Why is that? And it's very simple. I've talked about this many times before, but it's really simple and really important, because if you have all kinds of desires on ill will, are you going to be calm? Of course not. How can you be calm if your desires, of desire by its very nature, draws you out of the present and draws you towards the object of your desire, which is in the future somewhere? Oh, I want to get there, I want to go that. Desire makes you restless, it makes you agitated even. Desire is the opposite of peace. You cannot be peaceful if you have desire. Ill will is exactly the same thing. Ill will has an object, usually a person that you have ill will about. Your mind goes out to that object, which is often in the past. So desire and ill will tend to take you into the past and into the future. Your mind cannot be peaceful, it cannot be calm if you have that. But the reality is, it is also true for clear seeing, for vipassana as well. It is exactly the same thing. If you are going to see clearly, you cannot have desire or ill will, because these are biases. When you desire something, you are biased towards that object. You don't see it clearly. One person might be in love with another person, and they are very biased towards the person they are in love with. Other people who are not in love with that person, they just shrug their shoulders. It's no big deal. But for the one who is in love, oh, so wonderful. Like Ajahn Brahm has these wonderful stories about, they're so wonderful, and then 2 years later you get divorced, and then everything is terrible about that person. Sometimes it is like that. Is it the same person? You start to wonder. Of course it is. It's just the bias of the mind has moved from one extreme to the other extreme. That's how we are as people. So to see clearly, you have to abandon those biases. You have to abandon those vested interests in the world. You have a vested interest in the things that are dear to you, in your house, in your belongings, in your family members. We all have vested interest in those things. But that means the mind is biased. And when the mind is biased, you cannot see clearly, almost by definition, because clear seeing is precisely lack of bias. So both vipassana and samatha come from the same source, which is a reduction in the defilements of the mind. So they always arise together. And for that reason, it can be misleading to talk about samatha meditation and vipassana meditation, because it might give the idea that one meditation leads to insight, whereas another one leads to calm. But actually, that is not really what samatha and vipassana meditation mean. What they mean is really that we focus is a bit different. The object we use is different, but the result is exactly the same. If you do vipassana meditation and it works, if it works, it means that your defilements go down. It leads to samatha and vipassana. They always have to go together. If you get vipassana, samatha always comes along. If you do so-called samatha meditation, then if you become calm, vipassana comes along with the calm. So regardless of what you do, whether it's called samatha meditation, whether it's called vipassana meditation, whether it's called contemplation, whether it's called development of perception, whether it's anything else that works and reduces your defilements in your mind and make you peaceful and calm, all of these things should always lead to both samatha and vipassana. That is how you know that you're on the right track. And they always have to come together in this way. So this is why this distinction between samatha and vipassana is sometimes misleading here. Yeah? Any meditation that works, no matter what it is called, whether it's called samatha and vipassana, leads to both of these results. They cannot be separated. And it's really a fundamental understanding of how this path works. So what does that mean? When we contemplate something, I was just talking about contemplation during this talk here. What does that mean? Is it samatha or vipassana? Well, now you know the answer, yeah? The answer is both. If you contemplate in the right way, if you are overcoming your defilements of the mind, it leads to two things, samatha and vipassana. Because if you are overcoming the defilements of the mind, you're creating the cause for both of them. And that's why they have to arise at the same time. So any contemplation you do, such as all the contemplations I talked about before, if they work, if they help you to purify your mind, then they are both about samatha and vipassana at the same time, both calm and clear seeing. This is the right way to think about it. If you watch the breath, are you doing samatha meditation or vipassana meditation? Well, actually, you're doing neither. You're just doing bhavana, you're doing meditation. And if the mindfulness of breathing works, and you're becoming more calm and peaceful, you are doing both samatha and vipassana, both calm and clear seeing at the same time. So everything in Buddhism should lead to both of these things at the same time. These are the two hallmarks, if you like, two opposite sides of the same coin, what happens when meditation works. You see clearly and you become calmer. So this is such an, I think, interesting point of view, because it kind of is a little bit at odds, perhaps, with sometimes how we are used to think about meditation practice. But this is how I understand the Buddha talking about this. The Buddha doesn't make a distinction. There's no distinction in the Buddhist teaching about samatha meditation or vipassana meditation. These two things are both the result of any practice that you do that works in the right way. But I want to finish off by talking about one more way in how to do contemplation. Yeah? And this is just to take the path all the way to the end, just to show you all the way where it goes. And the most powerful kind of contemplation you can have is the contemplation you have after a very profound state of meditation. That is when it really starts to become profound. So I have looked at the very basic contemplations that we do. I've looked at the contemplations that we do during ordinary meditation to purify the mind. And now just very briefly, just to kind of fill out the picture completely, think about the contemplation that happens after very deep meditation. This is very interesting as well. And this is the contemplation. You come out of a deep state of samadhi and you look back on what has happened. And why is that so powerful? And the reason why it is so powerful, and this gives an understanding of the connection between deep samadhi, deep stillness of the mind, and clear seeing. Yeah? When you look back at that, what you see is that a large portion of the world has come to an end. The deeper your stillness is, you may have noticed that tonight, even here tonight a little bit, things calm down. What does it mean that things calm down? It means things coming to an end. Yeah, less thinking, some of the thinking comes to an end. That's what it means. And you will have noticed that when things come to an end, it's marvelous. It's just, wow, this is what it means when things come to an end. Bring it on. I want more ending, please. Let things end. Yeah, ending is great. The more you get into ending of things, that's when you really start to understand the Buddhist path. The more stuff ends, the better it gets. The more profound your stillness, the more things have ended. And when you get into a real state of deep meditation, almost everything has come to an end. And that is why it is such a powerful moment of seeing clearly, of insight, of understanding reality. Yeah. And then you contemplate that experience, you look back, and what you see is that the whole world ended. All I had left was bliss and peace. And wow, it is so beautiful. You understand the impermanence of the world, how unreliable it is, how it can all be given up. And as you give it all up, it becomes even better. You understand the suffering of the world, because when you give up all of this stuff outside, which you know somehow is unsatisfactory, but you have never really understood it fully, now you fully understand how completely unsatisfactory that world actually is, because all the bliss happens when you give it up completely, and when you are immersed in that world, you come back to the problems of that world. And you also understand the most profound aspect of the Buddhist teachings, which is the idea of non-self, the idea of anatta. Why? Because you give up the whole world, and when you exit from that whole world, you have no more control of that world. It means that world has got nothing to do with you. You give it up, you feel far better. You have no relationship to it anymore, and you understand that you are beyond that world outside for the first time. You get the beginning, the starting point of a glimpse into non-self. Is that right? Do you agree? Okay, not sure. Okay. So that is the really profound insight that comes. And that is the contemplation you do when the meditation becomes really profound and you start to turn upside down your understanding of the world. You start to understand where real happiness is to be found and what the meaning of life truly is about. And that comes, that is the last kind of contemplation that we do. And from there, the way the path to Nibbana is paved with, what is it paved with? Not good intentions, bad, whatever it is. It is not paved with anything. It just happens almost automatically because you're so close to that end of the path, very close to the end of everything, and things happen more or less automatically. But I just want to briefly just summarize what I have been talking about. And one of the most important things about contemplation practice, and one of the things I really would suggest that you focus on from all of the things I have been talking about, is the basic things, yeah, simple contemplations that help you have an appreciation in your daily life, to count your blessings on a regular basis. Wow, how fortunate I am to be able to come to a place like Nolamara, Dhammaloka Buddha Center in Nolamara, that give me such an uplift and support for living a good life. These kind of things, how to overcome anger, the simple things in life. If you can do that much, you're going to have a really, really good spiritual practice as a consequence. And then, as your meditation starts to take off, you bring that same contemplation into your meditation practice to understand how to overcome the defilements and problems also in your meditation. So, that is all for tonight. And I wish you good luck in your practice. Okay, very good. So I hope I haven't scared anyone too much. And now if anyone would like to make some comments or ask questions, or if you really have to complain, you can complain too, but thank you very much. But please feel free to ask. Yes, over here.
Good evening to both Ajahns and all fellow Buddhists. I have one question here. One of the questions posted to you was what was the difference between let it be and let it go. In your reply, Ajahn mentioned about the neutral place that you need to be to gain insights after the initial phase of letting it be. Can Ajahn please elaborate on this neutral place and how to get to that neutral place?
Okay. So thank you. Letting be means that you don't control things. Yeah. So if you are meditating, for example, you allow the flow to happen. You don't judge yourself. You don't say, oh, I'm thinking bad things, I'm thinking good things. You don't think, oh, this sound outside. Why is this sound outside? People should be quiet. You don't think anything like that. You just allow things to flow. This is the meaning of letting be, not controlling, not getting your willpower involved in things. And what happens when you let be is that it enables you to see things clearly. Why? Well, because if you don't let things be, if you control things, basically you are run by desire and ill will, as I was saying before. And as long as you're run by desire and ill will, you will be biased. And that bias will stop you from being able to see what is really going on. But if you let things be, it's like you're standing back, allowing things to happen on the screen of your mind. And then you can see the causality of things. You can see this happens because of that. Then you get insight into what is happening. And you think, okay, I'm getting upset because of this. Then you change your perception on the spot, and then you let go of that straight away as a consequence. Letting be is watching. Letting go is more like an active change in your perception, which allows you to just let go of the whole thing straight away. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. Great.
If the samatha and vidarshana are interrelated, why is Lord Buddha stated different 40 samatha bhavanas and four categories of insight meditation differently?
Okay. Thank you for that question. This is one of the misunderstandings, is that four types of insight meditation. The Buddha doesn't call it that. The Buddha talks about four satipatthana. Four satipatthana is often said to be vipassana practice. Yeah, very often you will hear that satipatthana is all about vipassana practice. This is a kind of a common understanding. The Buddha never says that. There's nothing in the word of Buddha which says satipatthana is vipassana. So to give you an example, one of the 40 samatha topics you're talking about, one of them is anapanasati, watching the breath. Yeah. Now, anapanasati is also satipatthana. Yeah. Have you read the Satipatthana Sutta? If you read the Satipatthana Sutta, one of the first things you will see in there is the breath meditation is part of the body contemplation. It's actually part of Satipatthana Sutta. So that means that Satipatthana Sutta includes breath contemplation. It cannot just be vipassana. If breath meditation is samatha, it means samatha is included in Satipatthana. In fact, if you go to the Anapanasati Sutta, which is the longest discourse on mindfulness of breathing that you find in the suttas, the Buddha very interestingly says that Anapanasati, just watching the breath, fulfills the four satipatthanas. Yeah. So if you all you do is watch the breath, you actually complete the course in satipatthana just by watching the breath, and yet the breath is called the samatha object. So this is the problem, is that this kind of thing, this idea that satipatthana is vipassana, is not really supported in the suttas. And yet very often this is the kind of thing you will hear, yeah, if you're not careful. So for this reason, I find it so important to go back to the suttas. And so when you do satipatthana practice, what you are doing is both samatha and vipassana, because they always go hand in hand. They cannot be divided up in this way. Check it out for yourself. Have a look at those suttas, and I think you will see that what I'm saying has very strong foundations in the suttas. Okay? Yeah? Okay, good.
How would you recommend wanting to be like an active participant in the world, trying to make things better, but that's also kind of like trying to control the world in a way, versus the frame of mind of then detaching and letting go?
Yeah. Okay. So the right way of thinking about kind of doing things in the world, and I think it's good. Yeah. I think it's a great thing to do good things. But the point is that it is precisely about doing good. Yeah, this is kind of the thing here. So you do it with an attitude of, okay, I would like society to be better. I would like future generations to inherit a good planet, not a waste dump or something like that. Yeah, so I'm going to do something to help that happen in the world. So you do it with a good intention. But at the same time, as you are doing that, you realize that actually, in the end, you're not going to be able to control it. It may not work out. maybe the planet is going to go to the dogs. It's possible. It's not a nice thought, but it is possible. Yeah, and sometimes you can't do anything about it. So you do your best without attaching too much to the results, because it's too uncertain what the outcome is going to be. Usually there's a middle way. We kind of fudge it somehow. Yeah, okay, the things go bad, a bit bad, and they get better again, and kind of you find a middle way somewhere. But don't be too attached to the result, because the planet, everything in the outer world is inherently unreliable, and you cannot really control it. So make it something as a part of your spiritual practice, to do good, to do kindness, because all of this will help you in a spiritual practice. But try not. It's very hard not to attach to the results, but try not to attach too much to the results. Yeah.
Thank you.
Ajahn, I'm here.
Oh, okay, please, yes.
Ajahn, you talked about contemplation.
Yeah.
And you also talked about people who don't believe in birth and rebirth.
Yeah.
My contemplation, my understanding, my intelligence level makes me understand my karma, my rebirth. What is the Buddhist's response that you would give to somebody who doesn't believe in rebirth?
Okay. I would say to them that don't reject the idea too quickly. Yeah, it's okay to be uncertain. It's okay to doubt. I mean, you can't force ideas onto people. That's also wrong. But don't just reject it out of hand. Be careful. If the Buddha, who, as far as I'm concerned, is the greatest spiritual genius in history, if he said there is rebirth, to me, that is good enough reason to at least be open-minded about it. Yeah, that's what I would say. Yeah? And then see how it goes. Yeah, reflect on it. Read about it. See. You know, look at some of the kind of evidence that also exists for the idea of rebirth. There actually is quite a bit of evidence for this. But because our worldview tends to go in a different direction, very often that evidence isn't taken all that seriously. Yeah? One of the things that is interesting is that, as far as I can see, there seems to be a kind of change even now in the how science looks at the world. Science is starting to understand that they are not able to understand consciousness on the basis of the material world as it is. Yeah, and they can't explain consciousness. How can consciousness arise from negatively and positively charged particles? Yeah, spin this way, spin that way. How can it arise from that? And there's no explanatory way you can explain that. There is what they call an explanatory gap between the physical qualities of the world and consciousness. So many people now, even scientists, there's a bit of feedback in the microphone. Is there anything we can do about that? Thanks. Many scientists, even philosophers, are saying that we need to re-look at this again in a different way and start to see if we can find another way of explaining the world. And I look at some of the evidence. This is what I would say to people. And then contemplate it. Read the word of the Buddha. Is the Buddha great or not? If he is great, well, take his view seriously, etc. And then go with it. And if you, at the end of the day, decide there is no rebirth, well, that's fine. You know, it's up to you. You have to decide. But at least give it a good investigation first.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Yeah. Okay. Please. Yeah.
Just a question about the Buddhist precepts pertaining to not causing harm to any being.
Yeah.
This month marks 20 years of me coming here.
Okay.
And the one thing that has been an ongoing theme that I've noticed is the lack of addressing something that's very, very obvious to some of us.
Yeah.
Which is because the Buddhist precepts pertain to not harming any being, which essentially is veganism, I feel that Buddhism seems to skirt around that issue, because I think a lot of people feel uncomfortable with that issue, because to take on board not harming any being means to make sacrifice in people's lives that a lot of people don't feel comfortable with, because they're addicted to animal products. And do you think that Buddhist monks and nuns and teachers deliberately avoid that issue because to maintain some sort of popularity, or do you think, or not to offend, or not to cause any cognitive dissonance in followers, or is there some other reason why that issue is being skirted around? Because I think, essentially, to avoid hypocrisy, I think anybody who follows Buddhism really needs to be vegan.
Yeah. Well, I think the reason is because, you know, in the end, it wasn't really laid down by the Buddha that you have to be vegan or you have to be vegetarian. And I think this is one of the reasons. That's interesting because one of the rules that we have as monastics actually came out of a discussion between the Buddha and another monk. He was known as Devadatta. He was and the discussion. One of the points of discussion was Devadatta said, "Well, all monastics should be vegetarian." Yeah, and the Buddha said no. Yeah, and of course, one of the reasons why, as a monk, it is difficult to be vegetarian is precisely because we rely on other people's generosity.
Yeah, I'm talking about lay people,
sure,
though.
Yeah, I can get into that in a second. I'll starting out my answer. Yeah, so this is kind of the first part of that answer, is that as monastic, well, sometimes you come to somebody. I actually tend to eat pretty much all vegetarian usually. But sometimes all you're given is meat. So then you have a choice to go hungry or eat meat. And to not to eat what you're offered would be very, you know, I think rude in those kind of situations. But the other thing, and this comes kind of to the lay community as well, and actually there's a lot of lay people, you'd be surprised, who actually are vegetarian, yeah? And even vegan. It's actually more common than you might think, yeah? But one of the reasons is that the Buddha does not lay it down as one of the basic precepts. Yeah, this is kind of, again, interesting. He says you shouldn't kill living beings, but he doesn't say that that is the same. That eating meat does not imply, is not the same as killing a living being. He makes a distinction between the two things. And I think this is why, as monastics, we don't teach that, because we would really be going beyond the word of the Buddha if he made that a kind of obligation on part of the lay people. But I would say, and from my point of view, I would say that I certainly think it is very good to be a vegetarian, and I would, if somebody says, should I be vegetarian or should I be meat? Well, if you are leaning towards being vegetarian, absolutely, go for it. It's a wonderful thing. Do it with a good heart. Do it out of care or compassion for all living beings. I think it's a wonderful thing. I would never say to anyone that they should not be vegetarian. In fact, I would support that kind of proposition almost in all circumstances.
I think that, well, veganism is different from vegetarianism because it's about not eating any products from animals, because they're essentially more than killed, they're tortured in order to produce those. So, but the thing is with lay people is that often, and this goes across all religions, is that we, and this is a common human trait that we all are guilty of, which is we have our ego and we have our pride and we have all these negative aspects to ourselves. And essentially, we want to think of ourselves as good people, but we also are lazy, and we also are greedy and selfish, and we have all those qualities. And that essentially is what feeds these industries, which do cause suffering. And so eating, if somebody ate something that died of natural causes, that's different. But when you're paying someone to essentially breed into existence, keep in captivity, torture and murder, then that's a completely conscious choice that people are making, and it goes completely against the Buddhist precepts of not harming any being.
Yeah.
It's just, that's science, that's fact. It's there's no skirting around that.
Sure. I think that there is something to what you say. I'm not going to disagree with what you say, but I also recognize that the Buddha didn't actually make it an obligation. Many people follow that. I would support anyone, and I would, I would say it's good. It's great to be a vegetarian, but I don't really want to judge anyone who is not a vegetarian, simply because it is not part of the basic five precepts. I think there is a kind of room there for slightly different viewpoints, depending on how you do it and what actually happens. But I appreciate what you're saying. Yeah.
Could you explain the definition of the precepts?
Sirs, I'm sorry. Actually, my question has something to do with that issue as well.
So I don't know where that voice is coming from. hello. I just wanted to understand firstly how the Buddhist precepts of not harming any being misses how that paying people to torture animals is somehow excluded from that. Because it surely is not excluded from that. I mean, not harming any being is pretty literal and straightforward.
I don't think anyone has the intention to harm beings just because they buy meat in the shop. Yeah, they don't usually even consider that possibility, and I think that is part of what's going on there. Yeah. But anyway,
consciousness is part of the teaching, isn't it? To make people conscious of what they're doing, so that we can cause less suffering by being conscious of the suffering that we cause.
Yeah. Okay. Let's stop it there. Okay. But thanks. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you for listening to my question. Yeah. Is it right or wrong to have more faith in a person if they seem to espouse Buddhist beliefs?
Is it right or wrong to have more faith in them if they espouse Buddhist beliefs? Okay. I would say, you know, faith and confidence has to do, I would say, more with the personal qualities of the person. Yeah, if you look at the Buddha, what makes the Buddha special is that he had very powerful personal qualities, and that would have been what attracted people. Yeah, they said, "Wow, this person is really special," and it is if your personal qualities are very powerful, that is when people listen to what you espouse and what you talk about. So the most important reason for having confidence or faith in somebody like the Buddha is because of the personal qualities. And then the secondary thing is the teaching that they give, I would say. Does that answer your question? I'm not sure.
Oh, yes, it answers it very well. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. Okay, maybe we better stop there. And I will just have a look at some of the questions from overseas. The first one is from a fellow called Michael. Not sure where he is from, it doesn't say. But he has the following question. Does contemplation of the Dhamma improve my meditation practice, and how can I do it during my working day? I really want to see progress in my meditation practice. So again, I think I have been covering that tonight. I don't know if you're, but absolutely, contemplation of the Dhamma or contemplation of some of the themes that I was talking about today, the idea of appreciating your co-workers, the idea of overcoming anger, all of this takes contemplation and reflection to be able to do that. And these are Dhamma contemplations, Dhamma reflections. So keep it simple, yeah? When you say contemplating the Dhamma, I'm not sure exactly what you mean. But, you know, some contemplations of the Dhamma might not be useful. Keep it down to earth. Keep it something that is really relevant. And that is when I think you will start to see great benefits of it. Okay, second question. DY from the USA. When contemplating on thoughts, should I use determination to replace the unwholesome with wholesome thoughts? What is the best way to use determination on the Noble Path? So the best, when you have unwholesome thoughts, yeah, and you want to replace them with wholesome ones, the best thing to use is to use wisdom. Understand why the unwholesome thoughts are problematic, how they lead to suffering, and you probably know that already, yeah? And then you shift your attention by remembering how negative it is and the kind of negative consequence that it has, and then you use a skillful means to be able to overcome those negative things. I just mentioned already before about overcoming anger, overcoming things by reflecting differently, look at the person in a new way, see their good qualities, remember their sides with compassion, remember that people have different outlooks on things, yeah, and then have compassion for people as a consequence. So this is kind of one of the basic ways. How do you use determination in the path? Well, the best way to determine things, and this is determination, I would call it commitment and perseverance. That's what I would call it. How can you commit and persevere on the Buddhist path? The most important thing is to have the right attitude, the right values in your life. If you have very powerful right values and right attitude, the commitment and perseverance comes automatically from that. So make sure that you value the right things, yeah? That you value kindness, that you value these things, that you look at the world in such a way that kindness, the whole path can almost be summarized in the word kindness. So if you look at the world in such a way that kindness becomes one of your main values, then the determination, if you like, or the commitment and the perseverance come as a consequence of that. So think about right view. Think about what is really valuable in the world. Remember, the world outside cannot be controlled, the world inside we have some control over. So work on the world, your inside world, your inside reality instead. When you work on that, you're working on something that actually you can do something about. Yeah, so this is what I mean by right view. But right view is quite broad. It's a thing that is underestimated on the Buddhist path. So investigate a little bit about the idea of right view, and then I think your determination will arise as a consequence. Okay, the third question is from Ning in Malaysia. Sometimes ill will is serious in unjust situations, like someone has harmed or wronged me. It is difficult for me to not react immediately, and sometimes we end up screaming. We know we need to withdraw, yet it is difficult to find control because I take things personally. I feel bad after and worry about the bad karma. Thank you for your advice. It is very difficult when things arise. Yeah, sometimes very powerful emotions come out if you feel wrong, and it's part of the human condition. So don't judge yourself too harshly. This is the first thing. You say you feel bad, but remember, this is common to most people. Yeah, some people react a bit more strongly than others, but almost everybody reacts sometimes when we hear things that seem unjust. So it's okay, yeah? Accept yourself for who you are. You have been conditioned in this way. Have kindness for yourself, even though sometimes you get angry. This is really the first step on this path. And then you have already gone a long way if you can do that much. The second thing to remind yourself, one of the things that I like to reflect on when other people do things that hurt me, is to remind myself it is not really personal. The reason why you get angry, as you say, you actually say it right here, is that you take it personally. Yeah. But why do you take it personally? There's nothing personal in it. The reason why the other person is acting the way they are is not because of you. They are acting the way they are because of their own inner states. That is why they act in the way they are. If someone else had been in your place who was roughly like you, exactly the same thing would happen. Got nothing to do with you. It's the other person's problem. So why are you reacting? So do you take the personality, the kind of sense of it being personal, out of the equation? It is never personal. It is always just, someone acting out the conditions of the past, like robots basically, acting out of the conditions of the past. So clap them on the shoulder, tap them on the shoulder and say, oh, it's okay, robot, yeah, you're just acting out your conditioning. Yeah. Don't say that, yeah? I like to say it, but think that, yeah? And because it actually is true, but the other person is not going to be ready to hear it, so don't say it, otherwise you get in deep trouble. Yeah. But that is the way to think, yeah? Actually, have compassion for them, because they are the one who have the problem. You don't have a problem at all. And gradually learn to think in this way. Think of the other person as a conditioned being who's just acting out those conditions. They don't have much choice. And realize, actually, they have a problem. Feel sorry for them. Have compassion for them. They are the one who has the problem, yeah, because they can't stop themselves from doing bad things. Then you have compassion for them. You don't react. And when you don't react, the chances that they will carry on for very long is very, very small, because you become like a mirror to them. If you don't react, they will start to see their own stupid actions. They become a bit self-conscious if you don't react. That's what I mean by a mirror. They start to see themselves instead. And then the situation becomes diffused very quickly. But think like this. Contemplate this idea again and again and again. These are very profound teachings. This is actually found in the suttas. This is recommended by Venerable Sariputta and the Buddha in a number of places, to think in this particular way. It's actually very profound and very useful. But you have to do it again and again and again. Then it becomes powerful. Then it becomes useful. It becomes a power. Pachavekana bala, the power of reflection. That's what it becomes. And then you can overcome all these unwholesome states as a consequence. Okay. Good luck. So that's all for tonight. So now let's pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.